Susan Cummings and Tiny Rebel Games were in the news recently with an announcement that they raised $7 million to build the Petaverse Network. I caught up with Susan last year to discuss AR for storytelling and city-scale games. Catch the full replay right now. Welcome to the AR Show, where I dive deep into augmented reality with a focus on the technology, the use cases, and the people behind them. I'm your host, Jason McDowell. Today's conversation is with Susan Cummings. Susan is the managing director of Tiny Rebel Games and a founder of Fictioneers. Susan and her team were awarded a major UK grant for augmented reality storytelling, which led to Wallace and Gromit: The Big Fix-Up. This effort was followed by the release this summer of Wallace and Gromit: Fix Up the City, an ambitious city-scale AR game that takes place in San Francisco, Bristol, and Cardiff. Including her work at Tiny Rebel, Susan spent more than 20 years in game development and publishing. She was a key player at the origins of Rockstar Games and held vital roles as the VP of Publishing and the VP of Business Development at 2K Games and parent Take-Two Interactive. In this conversation, Susan shares insights into the origins of Grand Theft Auto and some other big deals and projects in the early days of console and PC games. She goes on to talk about the challenges in telling compelling stories with AR.
It starts with you joining Wallace's company and becoming a member of Spick and Spanners, and you start doing jobs and you start encountering characters. And over the course of the story, you know, it heats up. So bad things happen. You save the day, right? But what would happen if we shook that up and started with Gromit getting kidnapped and then go back to find out why? And that's what we do in film, right? Film started with traditional stories, and then we started tinkering with it, messing with it. And so that, I think, is the next step, is that was a great experiment. How could we make that better from a pacing standpoint? How could we start with a conflict? And how can we leave you on cliffhangers every day? So that sort of iteration, I think, is what happens next to telling a great story.
We also talk about some of the lessons learned in making compelling and accessible city-scale AR-based games for mobile and the challenges of immersion in see-through AR glasses. A quick note of disclosure, I'm an investor in Phantasmo, one of the companies Susan mentions when describing her efforts at Fictioneers. Let's dive in. Susan, I remember I really got into gaming in the 90s. Like, this was the beginning of the PC gaming era. Consoles were really taking off at that time. And one of the most notorious games, I think still of all time, was Grand Theft Auto. And you have a lot of insight into Grand Theft Auto. How did that franchise come to be?
You know, I don't think the whole story has ever really been told, funny enough. But so Grand Theft Auto, I came across because I was working with BMG Interactive in the States. This is when I was a recruiter, my earliest days in the game industry. And I was doing a lot of work with them. And BMG decided to get out of the games business, at least in America. It wasn't going so well for them in the States. And so I was introduced to the people running BMG Interactive in Europe, which was Sam Houser. His boss was a guy named Gary Dale. And they approached me about signing off the rights, the US rights, to all of their products, including Grand Theft Auto. And so I spent a fun period of time talking to most of the game publishers in the States about this game that no one had heard of, this top-down, still my favorite GTA, I have to say, the top-down cartoony Grand Theft Auto. Funny enough, we were about to sell the rights to THQ, and THQ thought they had the rights to this, to the point that it was in their marketing materials to pitch out there to retailers. It turned out that BMG was actually going to sell the company to a company that I don't think anyone will have ever heard of anymore, called American Softworks, which is a little company in Connecticut. And American Softworks was about to buy BMG Interactive. And Ryan Brand was running Take-Two at the time. Ryan passed away, but an old friend of mine. He's running Take-Two, and he used to call me at 2 o'clock in the morning about deals. And he said, "Susan, I heard that BMG is getting out of the business, and How do I get involved in this? How do I buy the company? Because I heard that someone's buying the company." And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about, because I didn't know. I was a nobody at the time, and they didn't bother to tell me they were looking at doing this. So I found out it was true, and I made this introduction. Now, Take-Two at the time was, you know, $5 a share, if that. Like, their stock was in a gumball machine in the lobby. They were doing horrible FMV games. And Ryan, probably the person I've learned most about deals from in my career, Ryan talks to them, and the next thing you know, American Softworks gets the PC version of Grand Theft Auto, and he takes everything else. And that over the next few years became Rockstar Games. And it took some time for it to gain traction. They did a surfing game that nobody wants to have ever heard of. And then eventually Grand Theft Auto 2, and then finally Grand Theft Auto 3, which was the one that really put it on the map and sold the PlayStation. But it could have gone so many other ways in the meanwhile.
That's amazing. 2 o'clock in the morning. How do I get into this?
Yeah.
What were the magic words that he said to the BMG folks in order to get everything except for the PC rights?
Ryan just knew how to do deals. Like, you know, the stuff that we did when we set up 2K, 2K was set up because Take-Two was just Grand Theft Auto. And even though that should be enough, it wasn't enough for Wall Street at the time. And we were getting hammered for the fact that there was nothing else. And so that's how I ended up setting up 2K with Ryan, was we needed to expand our IPs. And Rockstar has always been very focused on the games that Sam Houser wants to make. And they take the time that they take to make, even if it's many years. Like, that's just their focus. 2K was set up with the idea that we need to do more than that. And so we had a couple hundred million at the time to go out there and sign projects. And so my role was to, A, apologize to a lot of developers, because Take-Two had the worst reputation of not paying people and, you know, screwing companies over. So I had to apologize first. And then suggest to them, look, we want to fund your stuff. What do you want to make? And everything that's 2K now came out of those early conversations. We signed BioShock when nobody else wanted to sign BioShock. We signed it as a $4 million project, which ended up costing far more than that. And we bought the studio, but it was a little deal. Borderlands was signed on a verbal pitch at E3. They pitched us on two games and we signed Borderlands out of it. Civilization and that whole Firaxis thing happened. I had a Friday phone call with Firaxis for the first time where they told me, hey, Atari's looking to sell off Civilization. And over the course of the next week, we had our lawyers in there. And by the end of the week, we had handed Atari $20 million and got them to throw in XCOM as a freebie. Meanwhile, EA, Sega, people had been in there for 3 months poring over things. And at the time, we were just making instinctual decisions. Like, no other PC games were selling at the time, but you knew Civ was going to sell. And it was an alpha. So there was nothing really to talk about. It was just a question of how much. And it's one of the problems in the game industry. It was that you used to be able to shoot from your hip like that and do a deal instinctually. And it's gotten so focused on sequels and trying to look at comparables. The whole point of original IP is there shouldn't be comparables. It should be something new. And that's a really hard thing for Wall Street to, you know, to get their heads around.
Yes. I can imagine it's quite challenging to convince a Wall Street banker type to trust somebody's gut. Just trust us. We know how to pick great content. We know how to pick great teams. So for you, how did you find your way into the gaming industry? Why was that a calling for you?
You know, I kind of stumbled into it. I got out of college. I went to Brandeis and I got a job as a recruiter. And the company that I went to work for wanted me to work in multimedia, which was still a term back then. And my boss threw a book at me of multimedia companies and said, do that. That's going to be your specialty. And so I started calling around and it turned out they were mostly video game companies. And I had no idea. I talked to people like Al Lowe without at the time really understanding who that was and what an icon Al was. But talking to people like that and getting to know people in the industry, it was a much smaller business back then. And it was actually possible to get your arms around it and know everybody in the space. And so I was a recruiter and I was a decent recruiter. And I did that for a few years and got bored. And then I started doing deals. And that's how I ended up, you know, involved in the Grand Theft Auto deal, other distribution deals. And then I got bored. And so I got into publishing as a deal signer. And then I really wanted to have my hands dirty. I hated the fact that I was involved in the exciting beginning and then I'd go away. So I got more involved in production. So I think my whole career has been about feeling like I've accomplished all I can in this. I need another challenge. So I've continued to kind of up the ante on the things that I don't really know, but I'm going to figure it out as I go along. And it's worked so far.
And it sounds like with each one of those iterations on your own career, you move a little bit closer to the making of the thing itself.
Yeah. And I constantly have this getting pulled back. So I started 2K and in the beginnings of 2K, I was running product development. And then very quickly, I started getting pushed the other direction. We need to build the product portfolio. So we brought in Greg Gobi to run product development. And it was really heartbreaking because I loved the fact that I was finally getting to be in the middle of it creatively and from a production standpoint. So yeah, so then I eventually started my own company with my husband. And so Lee all the while was on the Rockstar side. And so he very quickly became Sam's sort of right hand on all of his the stuff that was important to him. So he worked on, you know, all the Grand Theft Auto products from a production and design standpoint. And then we were doing Bully, and Bully was about to get killed. So they moved Lee, my husband, up to Vancouver for the better part of a year to sort of save the project. which was great for him. It was the hands-on experience that, he needed as well for his career. And when we left, realized that between the two of us, we'd been working alongside each other, but not together on different labels. We realized that we kind of knew what we needed to know from a production and design standpoint to be able to go out there and do stuff together, which is cool. I don't think many people could do that, to be married and to work so closely together for a dozen years now, I guess, since we set up Tiny Rebel.
That's amazing. So you were focused initially on primarily on console.
Yes.
And what happened as you kind of got together with your husband to start your own stuff? What was the focus at that point?
So we set up the company to sort of originally be like guns for hire. And we had friends that we'd pull in on projects as well. We worked with Atari, we worked with Majesco, and then Paramount hired us to run their games group. I remember the meeting where we were asked if we wanted to work on the next Star Trek video game. And I called my husband and he's like, how much do we have to pay them for that privilege? So we moved to California. We were moved out there to run this Star Trek video game, which should have been the best Star Trek game ever made. Unfortunately, it was probably the worst Star Trek game ever made for reasons beyond our control. But we moved out there and, you know, got to work with Bad Robot and others on this video game that was meant to take place between the first two of the Star Trek movies. Unfortunately, Paramount kind of got in the way of that vision. But so we moved out there for that. And then we did a War of the Worlds game with Patrick Stewart, which is pretty awesome too. And then we tried to get funding to do a sort of ambitious shooter. And at the time, mobile games was just heating up. And what seemed like a really small budget coming out of my Take-Two brain was suddenly a lot of money considering what you could do on mobile for the same. And so we didn't really want to make mobile games. We saw them as, you know, these awful time sinks and energy meters. And Lee, as a designer, is like, why would you tell someone the minute they fall in love with your game to go away and come back? It just seems so counterintuitive. So we got the rights to Doctor Who, and we did our first mobile game called Doctor Who Legacy, which I'm really proud of. We did a few million installs of that game without spending any money on user acquisition in a different time when you could actually do that. But it was all the things that we wanted it to be. It was called by Kotaku one of the fairest versions of free-to-play they'd ever seen, which probably also means we could have made a lot more money if we hadn't been such a fair game. But it became this really loved thing within the Doctor Who world. So I'm proud of that. And then we did another Doctor Who game. And then a few years ago was when we started to jump into mixed reality, when the Welsh government encouraged us to bid for an immersive grant, not an AR grant, but an immersive creative immersive grant from the British government.
Yeah. Tell us about that offering. What were they trying to accomplish, this Welsh government? Why were they the ones putting up the money? And what did you end up proposing?
The Welsh government pushed us to do it. It's actually the British government. So there's a group called Innovate UK, and Innovate put aside about £30 million of R&D funding. There's a lot of R&D funding in the UK. One of the things I've learned as an American over here is that you can actually get the government to fund creative R&D, which is really exciting and gratifying as a creative person. But it's a variety of challenges that you have to pitch for, but half of the money went to 4 demonstrators. And so we had to pitch alongside a few hundred consortiums of companies, not even just our company, a consortium of companies, to get this money. And so we bid for what was called the moving image demonstrator. And we proposed that we would tell a story in a new way, that we would tell a story in real time and use AR in a more holistic way and use it to bring another world into ours and experiment with mixed reality. But keep in mind, we came into this with no AR experience. This was new grounds to us. And we built a team around it. You know, we started with a small group and it ramped up to probably 30, 35 people, including Artmen, over the last couple years to make the big fix up.
How did Wallace and Gromit become part of this?
When we got the grant, we had a different IP involved. And when that sort of went awry at the last minute. And so we had the opportunity to actually go out there and tell people we had money and we needed an IP. And Aardman were actually the very first company we sat down with about it. We had plenty of conversations, but they were the first. And I was so impressed with how in love they were with playing and experimenting in a way that I'd never seen before from IP companies. You know, having worked around Paramount and having worked with the BBC, I've never seen a company like more willing to take risks and be playful with really valuable IP. And they were from the beginning. They announced the project in its earliest days, where most IP holders would want to wait for something like that. So yeah, they shared our enthusiasm for the idea that a story could be told in real time and that we could use AR as a way of thinking about it.
And so how do you tell a good story using augmented reality in a more holistic way?
Well, in our case, we started from scratch. We started the way you would make a movie. And we said, let's think about this that way. We don't want to tell a story that already exists because we want users to be surprised and we want to give them some agency and you know, culpability in the story and to make them feel a part of it. And so Aardman came up with a few concepts and pitched us on them. And then our team and their team spent a good couple months at least in a writer's room together mapping out the story. And nothing existed to do what we needed to do because we needed to figure out, first of all, what the sort of three-act story would be. But then we had to figure out what the sort of beats were that make up that story. And then we had to figure out what the best way was to tell each of those beats of the story. And that was super complex. I mean, we spent months doing that. It's, you know, there's 200 pieces of story delivered through the big fix-up. And then not only that, we had to figure out a way that we could tell that story to everybody at the same time. And how we could deliver that in sort of a sort of cloud-based authoring tool standpoint. So we built the MUST platform, and that's what the MUST platform is for. The entire story lives as beats in the cloud, and we can do all sorts of stuff with that. So we can say it's going to be a 28-day story for everybody, which is what we did when we launched. And that's in real time. So any day during those 28 days you join and you catch up with the story already in progress and you progress. After we launched, we started doing staggered timelines where we'd say, it's based on you, and it's 10 days long. And over the course of the next 10 days for you, you'll experience the story. Then we moved it down to 5 days. And then we said, actually, every day, we're going to deliver you a chunk of content in the morning over the next 5 days. So we've done all these experiments since we've gone live because it's sort of the showcase of the MUST technology. It's an experiment. We didn't have a marketing budget, so it was never meant to be a massive commercial success. It was always meant to be, you know, what's possible. And it's allowed us to, you know, sort of keep playing and tinkering and thinking about story with the Aardman team, because they're just in love with figuring that out. You know, we told it as a three-act story. It starts with you joining Wallace's company and becoming a member of Spick and Spanners, and you start doing jobs and you start encountering characters. And over the course of the story, you know, it heats up. So bad things happen and then you save the day, right? But what would happen if we shook that up and started with Gromit getting kidnapped? And then go back to find out why. And that's what we do in film, right? Film started with traditional stories, and then we started tinkering with it, messing with it. And so that, I think, is the next step, is that was a great experiment. How could we make that better from a pacing standpoint? How could we start with a conflict? And how can we leave you on cliffhangers every day? So that sort of iteration, I think, is what happens next to telling a great story.
How does the user experience the story ultimately through their devices?
So they experience it through an app. The app is your employee app as an employee of Spick and Spanners. And part of this is because of the limitations of AR right now while we're holding the phone, right? We spent a lot of time thinking about how long can someone hold their arm out like that before they start to get, you know, fatigue, and, you know, what's the best user experience? We started thinking the entire app should be in AR. You know, you should have your AR workshop where you build contraptions and you send them off. We very quickly realized that's going to be awful on a mobile phone. And so then it became, this should be a 2D experience. Which are the, you know, what are the experiences that are sort of the show-stopping experiences? When do the AR things happen? As a user, you install the app and it has tabs like you'd expect, you know, an app to have as an employee. And there's a story feed where the story plays out and you can swipe through more news sort of Tinder style. There's a jobs board where you can take on jobs and send off your contraptions. There's a sort of a social board where characters chat back and forth with you. And then there's an area that we call the playground, which uses Unity's Mars technology to place stuff and have things move around your space. So you can hang things on walls and put a coffee cup on the table and have your contraptions move around the room. And it's just a little AR playground of sort of fun with stuff from Wallace's world.
How important was place in the telling of the story?
Well, it was meant to be very important before the pandemic happened. The original plan for the story, the three-act story, was that Act 3 would take place on the streets of Bristol. And Phantasmo LiDAR scanned Bristol for us. We talked to lots of different companies about SLAM technologies, and we ended up partnering with Phantasmo, who've been great to work with. And so they'd scanned Bristol, and we were all sort of set to go with the notion that, you know, at the end of Act 2, Gromit gets kidnapped, And there's this countdown to Grubfest, and this whole big festival is happening where Grub is trying to get elected mayor, and we're going to tell users to come to Bristol and have this experience. And we always had this notion that not everyone can get to Bristol. And so there was always this plan for an at-home experience that we kind of minimized because we wanted people to come. But there was going to be this kind of lowest common denominator. You could have this thing at home and still feel like you knew how the story ended. And then the pandemic happened, of course. And so what we did was we took the data from Bristol and we turned those into scalable dioramas that you could have within the app. So you could place them on your tabletop or you could place them in the back garden and actually have quite a large experience. Not quite what Bristol would have been, but a reasonably interesting experience. What happened then was that the government gave us additional funding to sort of for that pivot to fund that and also to agree to still do it when it was feasible this year. So starting January, we started working on something called Fix Up the City. And Fix Up the City takes place in Bristol, in Cardiff, and in Yerba Buena Gardens in San Francisco. And what we've done is we've scanned the locations and created a new experience that feels a bit like a carnival. And so it's not Act Three. It's something altogether itself. But the conflict is the same. You have to save the day and save Wallace. But it's a game. So whereas Big Fix Up is a story, and we went to great pains to try to explain to people that it's not a game. Don't think of it as a game. It's a story. This is a game. We want this to feel like a game. We want you to go there and have fun. Not punishing. You know, we don't think that AR is ready for punishing gameplay. Like we think that it's overwhelming enough as it is that it should make you feel clever. It shouldn't punish you. And so it's not hard gameplay by any means, but it's cool. I haven't seen anything like it. You know, because of the phantasma scanning, the world really does come to life around you in AR. And so it's not about just doing a little job. It's about the balloons in the sky and the fake bunting on the walls and carnival props and stuff like that, that really, you know, give it this richness that makes it feel real. You splatter paint and the paint actually splatters on the wall in front of you. Big lad jumps down off a building if you're in Bristol. If you're in Cardiff, he punches his way through the front of the Wales Millennium Center. You know, if something gets smashed by Big Lad, you could turn around and you could still see the dent of it in the ground. It's just really, really cool. And you can see that's it gives you a glimpse of where AR is headed when we have glasses in the future.
So people need to get themselves to Bristol, Cardiff, or Yerba Buena Gardens in San Francisco.
Starting this weekend. Friday, I think, is the official day it'll be available.
By the time we publish this, will be in the past. So yeah, by the time everybody hears this, it'll be available now.
Exactly.
Fix Up the City.
Yeah, Wallace and Gromit Fix Up the City.
I'd love to maybe dig in a little bit more into the perception you have around creating a good gameplay experience, outside of the storytelling experience, but the good gameplay experience around AR. You'd noted that AR is overwhelming itself right now, that it shouldn't be a punishing game. The user should feel more clever as they kind of go through it. How did you come to that conclusion? How did you kind of think through what's the right sort of gameplay experience for something like this?
We had a heavy focus on user research because it was an R&D project, and University of South Wales brought researchers into the project from the start. And so we started getting things into people's hands before we even had an app. We had you know, paper that we ran people through what the experience would be as a storyboard. And we were really surprised by how hard AR is for people, and the things that we assumed people already would know how to do, they don't know. And so, for example, if you had the wrong trousers and you wanted to make them bigger or smaller and they were anchored in front of you, someone in AR would know to just walk towards it, you know, or to back up. And instead, we found people wanting to pinch and make things bigger and smaller like that. And we found that they didn't necessarily quickly know how to interact with things. And so we called it AR coaching, and we spent a lot of time on that, of thinking about what the right sort of methodology is on screen to show people where they can interact with things, to explain to them how to scan a space, to explain how to anchor a space. I mean, guys, the scanning is the most exhausting thing about AR in mobile. I think most of us would agree. It's not fun, and you have to keep doing it. And so looking for ways to make that fun is something in our minds at Tiny Rebel as well, is how do we make that a better experience for people since it's not going away anytime soon.
This is the notion of having to move the camera around to understand what it is that's around you. It needs the phone, the whole system still needs a little bit of time to kind of figure that all out.
Yeah. I mean, we have a demo that I've shared online of some work we did with LiDAR on the phone, which has pigeons coming out of the walls and landing on tables and things like that. And it's lovely to look at. It takes a lot of scanning to get it to work that well. To try to explain to a user, A, that they have to do a lot of scanning, and B, why they should bother to do it thoroughly. You know, what the reward is for the fact that you actually got down and looked at the angles around the couch and things like that. But it's not a great user experience, is it? Nobody wants to do that.
Yeah. So in the case of the city fix-up, there that you've already pre-scanned these
yes.
particular places.
Yeah.
And so now the technical challenge is just about positioning. Okay, given that we already have the scan, how quickly can we get the phone to recognize exactly what it's looking at within this known space?
Correct. And yeah, that's not, it's still not perfect either. You know, it definitely hasn't been quite as easy as we expected it to be. We've gotten there. You know, we've found that, you know, for example, the earliest scans that we had, there was this sort of default of constantly rescanning. And that was frustrating because sometimes it was perfect. And then suddenly it was offset because the app decided to rescan. So we did away with that. We actually let the user adjust a little bit. It's one of those sort of behind the curtain things that, you know what, it actually makes it better to let a user do that. And if you're going to have a better experience, it's okay to ask somebody to offset a little bit to make it a better experience. It's one of the things that we found. But yeah, it's so much better. It's so much better when you don't have to ask a user to do anything. You know, the first time you actually see Big Lad stamp on a contraption and you see it embedded in the ground, you know, you realize that this is something different from what we've seen before. Or you watch Big Lad smash a building and you see the rocks pool on the ground, you know, at your feet. It takes it to another level.
As you noted, when you came into this project originally, this was you had not done AR before. Mm. And so you've been working very closely with Artiman and how to tell a great story using this medium. You've been thinking very deeply about how to create a great gameplay experience around this medium. You have the benefit of having the resources to do lots of research around it, which is hugely beneficial to you. But also, is there an obligation for you to share that more broadly with the community, kind of the research that's being done?
Yeah, the university is doing a lot of that. Is doing a lot. Did a lot of the sort of documenting and output of the project for sure. It is part of it. Yes.
And you'd also mentioned that part of your learning was that you didn't have a key tool that you needed, which was ultimately some way to manage the multi-user real-time storytelling experience. What went into this? You call it the MUST platform, M-U-S-T. What goes into that?
MUST is amazing. So Fictioneers, the group that we assembled as part of this grant, is a few companies that came together, you know, ours being one of them. Potato is one of the partners, and then they're part of AKQA. And they have a wonderful background in building sort of scalable backend systems. It was one of the reasons why we got them involved in the project. And one of their engineers, James Spencer, I remember him coming into the project, and there were a few months that it just felt like he was off intellectualizing and asking lots of questions. And you're wondering where it was all going. And I still remember the first sprint where he finally showed us the MUST platform. And it suddenly became the coolest part of the project. As excited as we were about AR, it was so cool to see this story working, because what's fascinating about the MUST platform is the time it would have saved us, because it allows you to simulate a story almost like you were assembling an orchestra. Hmm. You know, you have these sort of swim lanes of activity, you have the AR stuff, you have the video animations and gameplay, and then you can hit play and simulate it and watch the story before you ever have to actually deploy anything. So in my mind, that means, we could have created this whole thing as a text-based story just to try it out and see how it worked, and then start building expensive content. So I think that's what's so interesting about the MUST platform. But yeah, we needed something that would enable telling a story in real time. And there was a period of the project where we were so focused on the big fix-up, and we kept saying we're going to tell it in real time, and we didn't have the ability to do that. But we have a really great engineering team as part of Fictioneers that built this, and they're going forward now and turning that into a software as a service solution.
Oh, amazing. So that'll be available to the broader community here soon.
Yes, we hope so. Yeah.
You mentioned Mars,
yes.
The Mars program from Unity. What were you using Mars for? How is that better than some other alternatives maybe?
So we started talking to Tiffany West and the Mars team early on in the project. You know, the great thing about the grant was, you know, if you go back to 2019 when we started development, was that everybody had cool tech that they wanted people to use, but no one really had funding for it because no one was funding AR or anything back for the most part back then. And so it was a great calling card to be able to come in and say, hey, we have Wallace and Gromit and we have funding and stuff, and we want to check out your tools and see if that can be a part of this thing. And so that's how we got to know Unity, and they were super excited about the project and have been so supportive every step of the way. We have a Slack with them, and you know, we get really quick answers and support from a tech standpoint. We were excited about Mars because of the fact that it could, and we're continuing, you know, within Tiny Rebel with some of our new activities to push Mars to use it to give things a semantic understanding of your space, because that's where it really comes to life, is the idea of something moving around your room and having that understanding of what different surfaces and walls are. It's, you know, it's what we're all hoping glasses will have in the future. And so right now on mobile, it's a great way of iterating and trying to push forward what's possible. But yeah, the big thing about Mars that we love is this, the rule system that allows you to create so that you can give a anchor realistic behavior based on that. And so I think we were one of the first companies to use the Mars technology for this.
Yeah, that's very cool. I've seen Unity get really excited about other types of projects over the years. And one of the stories I hear is that they've just been a great partner. And it's great to hear that you have the same experience working with Unity.
Yeah, absolutely. They're really excited about Fix Up the City too. They're a sponsor of the city scale experiences. So they've been helping, you know, with some funding and some PR activity and stuff around the city scale experience, because, you know, again, it's just a showcase of their stuff.
Yep.
You know, we use AR Foundation, we use the high definition rendering pipeline we used for the creation of the lovely videos and Big Fix Up, and we used Unity as a library and Flutter. So it's just a lot of different sort of lines of Unity loves it when you're using lots of their stuff. And
sure.
So they've been really excited about how many different facets of Unity technology we brought into this.
The other company you mentioned was Phantasmo.
Yeah.
The value add, I guess, is they map the city using LiDAR technology in this case, but they map the city and then allow you to position, exactly figure out where the phone is relative to the real world based on that mapping.
Exactly.
Any other notable companies you looked at that are worth mentioning?
Oh, we talked to lots of companies. We were looking at Azure Spatial Anchors from Microsoft for a while. We looked at Sturfy. We looked at Scape. We talked to 60. So pretty much anyone who was out there at the time, we looked at. Phantasmo really liked the fact that they could also go indoors because of the backpack solution. Didn't end up doing anything indoors, but we liked the fact that we could. Because they had a background as a developer as well, they were really just sort of the same mindset with us and really sort of pitched in when we hit pain points, including when COVID started, helping us think about how we could take that data and use it within a home setting. So they've been really great partners every step of the way.
Amazing. Any other kind of key partners that you encountered that kind of really made for a great experience?
Miro. We use Miro for storyboarding. We absolutely love Miro. They've been so wonderfully supportive of us too as a venture. And I don't know if you've used Miro before, but we use it for all of our storyboarding. We must have made 250 Miro boards over the last 2.5 years because I've been trying to archive some of the stuff. But we found Miro to be an indispensable tool for what we're doing. Figma, you know, so what's wonderful, I guess, and because of the pandemic, it's gotten even more so. There are so many wonderful online collaboration tools that it's no longer necessary to be in the same room with people.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of doing a city scale game, of having kind of users out kind of in the real world, engaging with real world things while also participating in the story itself that you're creating through the mobile app. Were there any other sort of issues you ran into around permissions or trespassing or anything else kind of that are not quite the first order things that you consider when making a game like this or an experience like this?
It's an interesting question because it's kind of the Wild West right now, right? In terms of, you know, insurance and public liability and all these sorts of things. We've had risk assessors involved every step of the way in thinking about the city scale experiences. Cardiff and the Cardiff City Council and the Welsh government has worked closely with us in terms of Cardiff. We've spent a lot of time just trying to do it the right way and keep people safe. So trying to make sure that, you know, nothing is near a body of water that you could fall into, or, you know, roads and things like that. So we've taken a lot of care in where we position these experiences. So there's that. You know, there are definitely a lot of open questions out there, not so relevant to this, but broader questions about, you know, who owns the rights to spaces in the virtual world. You know, can you put something on the wall of a building that belongs to somebody else and have it be permanently anchored there? And like, what does that mean? Like, are they owed money for that? Could you offend somebody? You know, could you put an anti-Trump billboard on Trump Tower in AR, and can you do anything about it? Super interesting questions. I don't think anyone knows the answer to yet.
Yeah. I think that we're going to stumble our way through it until we kind of decide and feel out what's right, or somebody with enough money and power dictates what they think should be right.
And think about NFTs, NFT ownership, and if you from an NFT standpoint own an anchor, but it's on somebody else's building, like what does that mean?
Yeah, super interesting. So, Fix Up the City is out now as of the time people are listening to this.
Yes.
And what's next? What's next for the Wallace and Gromit and kind of the storytelling or gameplay around it, or what's next for Tiny Rebel Games?
So Fictioneers was an entity that came together for the project, like I said, with a few companies, ours and Potato and Sugar. Everyone is sort of also off onto their other stuff. And so for Tiny Rebel, we've been working since January, really on, we have a few projects in place, and our focus is really on being multi-platform and having our hands in everything, because we think in the future, it's going to be about being able to migrate between different devices. So, you know, your AR headset, your mobile phone, your VR headset, your smartwatch, web. And so right now it's about, we spent the last 3 years gaining a ton of competency in creating Unity app, you know, AR experiences, you know, essentially. But what we hadn't done was web XR. We hadn't done social. We hadn't, you know, touched a wearable device other than playing with a Magic Leap. And so this year has really been about us sort of spreading out into those other platforms. And so we have a new IP that we're working on, and the focus is really on how can it be in as many places as possible, as opposed to just how do we create a mobile AR experience.
So your career starts with introduction to multimedia, and now it's at multi-platform.
Yes.
So as you kind of reflect back on your period in the PC gaming, the work that you've done on the mobile side, are there any sort of like patterns you see emerging in the early days of AR that you've seen before in these other cycles?
Ooh, well, I think it's the Wild West, right? Like in the early days of video games, you know, when you think back to the arcades and coin-op games and how simplistic they were, part of that was obviously a limitation of the technology, but it was also that it was something new and someone walked into an arcade and put a quarter in and they had to be able to quickly figure out what they were meant to do. And I think that's one of the reasons why AR right now needs to be so focused on simplicity and just sort of getting everybody to the same level that we know what to do when we open an AR experience. And so I think that that's part of it is you look at what's getting people excited online. What was on Twitter, someone doing Pong got Verizon's CEO tweeting about it or something like that. And it was just literally like, you know, monochrome Pong. And I think that kind of, and that's cool. It was awesome. But I think that kind of shows where we're at right now is we're still having to just prove out the building blocks of what's possible with the sort of hardcore technologies like Unity and Unreal, but also with, you know, with things like Spark and Eighth Wall and stuff, what's possible. There was this wonderful chart that Oscar did online that I'm sure you saw that compared all the different tools and what they can and can't do. There's so much disparity right now. And for developers, it's really daunting just to get your head around. So who uses LiDAR? Can I use LiDAR with that? And can I access the phone? How many planes can we, you know, so there's just so many questions and it's just really impossible right now to think about how can we be everywhere. And that's one of the reasons we're spending so much time thinking about it this year is, so how do we think about it? Because clearly in the future, we do need to try to be in as many places as possible.
So where do you think it goes from here? If right now we're kind of in this fundamental building box, getting people familiar with the basic types of interactions that are possible, what does that look like 5 years from now? What do you think AR gaming and storytelling go over the next 5 years?
Well, I think we need to first figure out what is a compelling use case for AR. You know, like Pokemon Go is obviously one of the biggest things ever, but we all know that it wasn't because of the AR. You know, it's because of the map game and Pokemon, obviously. But the AR is something that most people turn off really quickly, which sucks. And so as much as you'd love to use it as a calling card for AR, it isn't so much. And that's partly because it is really hard to find the use cases that make it better. We're doing some work right now with one of the AR tools to try to figure out, like, so what are the prototypes that you could do? How do you think about gaming with a tool like an Eighth Wall or a Spark or, you know, the Snap Lenses, Lens Studio? Like, what's possible and what makes it a better experience than just having a 2D UI? And so I think we need to figure out that. I think we need to figure out the mechanics and the sort of verticals that make sense. And it needs to make it better. It can't just be, I can do it in AR. It has to be, I prefer to do it in AR.
Mm-hmm.
And partly that's going to take the glasses, right? But I think we can't ignore mobile as an AR platform, even if it's not the experience that glasses are going to be, because there are tons and tons and tons of mobile devices out there that are AR capable. And so little has been done, partly because most game publishers don't want to fund AR games, you know, but there's so much more that can be done. And so that excites us. And I think also mobile AR is so far ahead of what wearables can do right now, especially like the iPhone 12 Pro, right? There's so much you can do with that phone that I think it makes sense to iterate there now. And then once the AR glasses start to catch up, you can start to migrate those learnings across. That's our strategy to it anyway.
Do you think there'll be a pretty natural transition from the learnings you have on the mobile side to glasses once they become more pervasive?
I hope so. It's something we're looking at now. There's definitely going to be challenges. You know, like AR glasses are so translucent compared to a mobile screen. And that really breaks the illusion for me. I remember seeing someone got part of the big fix up working on the Magic Leap for me. And I was just put off by how translucent it was. It's so vivid on an iPhone. Mm-hmm. And it looked so washed out. And so that's going to get better and better, obviously. But for now, I think it's a matter of figuring out how to play to its strengths. It's just like a mobile phone. You know, you don't do stuff that breaks the illusion. And so it's a lot right now. It's a lot of trying to figure out how to work around it and make it feel like a feature as opposed to a bug. So I do think so. I think that, you know, we still play around with our Oculus Quest, and I'm excited about the pass-through API that's coming. So I think we have to think about hand gestures, and that's a harder thing to do on mobile. And so I think either looking at the early AR glasses or things like the Magic Leap or looking at the Quest with a pass-through can help us to start thinking about what the right hand gestures are for control, because I think that's really important too.
Yeah, I think this notion of the see-through nature of AR glasses is probably one of the biggest challenges to overcome for telling a compelling story where you're trying to transport the user, at least the mindset of the user, from the current location to some alternative reality.
Yeah. Well,
apparently now we've all decided to call the metaverse, although I'm still not comfortable with that branding.
I'm not either. I know.
But that see-through nature really makes it challenging because you will always have some hint of the real world. And even if you don't have a hint, if you're able to make that lens bright enough or the contrast high enough that you really just focus mentally on the virtual image, what are the safety concerns to the extent that the user is moving through the real world while they're consuming this alternative reality in the course of a story or a gameplay? Mm. What are the safety implications, the practical implications of that sort of thing that's blocking your eyes at that point?
The whole UI that's going to involve, right? I think the UI of AR glasses is going to be fascinating because it's not going to be like, it can't be like VR. It can't be an experience that takes over everything you're doing because you might be sitting in a cafe talking to somebody. And so to me, it almost feels like it's like widgets. Right? You're going to want to be able to have your map experience open and, you know, there might be dragon flying around and, you know, you're listening to your music and you're doing all these things and it kind of feels, it's almost like a HUD. You're going to have to be able to do a bunch of things at the same time, as opposed to the Oculus where you go in and you pick your game and you shut everything off. Like it's going to have to be a different way of thinking about UI and apps. They can't be traditional apps, right?
That's right. That's right. I can imagine in the early days, we're going to see lots of stories using ghosts and some other sort of ethereal plane.
definitely.
Takes advantage of the fact that everything's translucent. That'd be fun.
Absolutely.
The glasses are what the industry as a whole are very excited about. But clearly, everybody has a mobile phone in their pocket today, and the vast majority of them can support a decent AR experience. And so that's really where the focus is and should be for a lot of these kind of AR-oriented efforts that are going on. But do you think, kind of given some of the unique challenges, that AR glasses will become a viable platform for storytelling and gameplay?
Oh, I definitely think so. I have no doubt in my mind that they're eventually going to be here. I mean, I don't know if it's 3 years or 5 years or 10 years until there's any sort of, you know, ubiquity to it. But I absolutely think that they're coming. I do think that, well, I do think mobile's a viable AR platform for games. I'm probably very, very in the small minority for saying that, but I just think it's just been barely tapped. And again, it goes back to figuring out what's a good game experience and what's just using AR, you know, for the sake of using AR. But I absolutely think it's coming with the glasses.
Given that the opportunity is today in mobile, does the gameplay experience need to be not just AR? Is AR enough?
I think you need non-AR as well. I do. I mean, it feels like it's a cop-out. But there are times where it's just not convenient to have AR. You know, if you're sitting on an airplane, you know, again, someday we'll all do that. If you're in a train or whatever it is, and you want to be able to have some experience around the app, then I think it's important that there's things that you can do that don't require AR. And I think it's a nice way of sort of bridging people into it. But I think you have to give it a purpose so that people don't just turn it off.
Right.
And so it's kind of, in my mind, Pokemon Go is maps first, a little bit of AR. I'd like to switch it around and say, this is an AR experience, but there are some things that you can do if it's not convenient to be in AR right now. Mm. And so I feel like that ratio needs to start swapping the other way for anyone to start caring about AR games.
Yeah.
And so little has been done, you know, going back to it. Pokemon Go came out. Lots of people said, we're going to make that too. You know, and there was the Ghostbusters one, the Jurassic Park one, and they all flopped because it was just the same game. And then no one had any other ideas. You know, there were some, you know, early, you know, by Dragon and things like that, but they all came out in sort of the early days of AR Core and AR Kit. So much more possible since those apps sort of came out and died. I think the biggest reason is that it's been hard to find investment. And I think it's starting to change. But last year, no one wanted to hear that you were an AR company, especially after Magic Leap, you know, imploded. Mm-hmm. It was like, yeah, we're done with AR. Come back to us in 5 years. And, you know, in conversations that I've had this year, I found that's changing. And I think that's partially because Facebook is so bullish about AR and Apple so bullish about AR. And so I think people are finally thinking that even if they won't be perfect, that something's coming. You know, Snap putting out their spectacles, Niantic announcing their glasses. And so suddenly it seems like even if it's not a quick win, it feels like investors are finally thinking that this is something that we should be starting to look at. And I hope that bleeds into games, you know, because there's a lot of people investing in video games right now, but a ridiculous amount of people investing in video games right now. But it seems to me that most of it is focused on very traditional, on console games or mobile games or PC games. They don't really want to touch the other space. And so interestingly, the investment side of AR is more from the investment guys who are looking at technology or looking at blockchain and NFTs and things like that. They're all starting to want to talk about AR. But I don't see a lot of the game investors quite yet saying that's a valid platform for games. We're happy to invest in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It has to be a part of something else. You know, if you can combine it with some other thing, metaverse, blockchain, other things, then people are starting to want to finally talk about AR.
Yeah. Let's wrap up with a few enlightening round questions.
Okay.
What commonly held belief about spatial computing do you disagree with?
Well, the term metaverse is a mess, as you and I discussed a little bit earlier and touched upon. And I think it's because it seems to mean everything and nothing all at the same time. So it just does my head in. Everyone's claiming it as theirs. You know, Fortnite's a metaverse. VR chat and Rec Room, they're metaverses. People doing NFT stuff is metaverses. AR is meta. You know what I mean? So yeah. It's this jumble of a term. And I think also when we think about what the metaverse means, I think that there are quite a lot of people out there who see it as like Ready Player One or Snow Crash, that 10 years from now, we're all going to be playing around in the same world. And that's our sort of second life. And I don't think it's that. I don't think, first of all, as a society, that we share interests enough that we could ever come up with a world that we'd all be happy to inhabit together. And so to me, metaverses are going to be a variety of different experiences. There'll be some game worlds that we can jump into and chats and stuff like that. But it's not one metaverse. It's going to be lots of them, is my opinion anyway. And I think right now is about creating the sort of standards that allow you to move things between those metaverses, you know, which is why the sort of NFT stuff that's happening is kind of interesting in terms of how that allows us to migrate things between virtual worlds.
Right. Yeah. I haven't quite wrapped my brain around what the term is meant to mean.
I know.
Much less what it actually might mean. You know, I don't like the connotation to the Snow Crash dystopian sort of world. I completely agree that I find it nearly impossible that we as a human race could agree on a single alternative reality. You can't even agree on this current reality.
Right?
Not even close. Even in a small geographical area, we don't agree on our physical reality. So a virtual reality seems even less likely.
Yeah.
But whether it's just the 3D version of a website, or meant to represent, you know, what is a website? Is it just a single online page, or is it, you know, a full SaaS app with all these kind of tooling behind it? What is the definition of a website, and what does that really mean in practice? Or is it really more about the set of capabilities and the screen through which you interact with it?
Yeah.
And if we decide that, okay, if there is some sort of 3D element in it that we're now going to rebrand it as metaverse, then I don't know, maybe that's what's meant. Anyway, nonetheless, as we have many games and websites and different experiences, movies, whatever you can plug yourself into today, we will have a variety of those things as they
many metaverses.
Encompass different, yeah, 3D types of technology, however you experience it, whether it's through, you know, the 2D, 3DS, 2.5D through your phone,
yeah,
which is not truly 3D, right? It's a single view. Or it's through a pair of glasses, or you know, whether that glass is a see-through, or it's a, you know, video pass-through, or VR directly.
I like to hope eventually the glasses will be one thing. And I know that there are a multitude of technical challenges to get there, but you'd like to hope that eventually we'll have glasses that can handle both of those things. And sometimes it's AR and sometimes they fog over and you can have your VR experience. You'd like to hope that within decades we'll get to that.
I think that's probably the right sort of thinking, the time frame to think about that sort of thing.
Yeah. I, not being an engineer, I know that there are profound reasons why it's hard. So, but I like to hope that we'll get there eventually. And that's because users don't care. They don't want to know if it's AR or VR or XR or metaverses. They don't understand that. People just want to have experiences. And
that's right.
So,
yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that the current, there are so many technical challenges. The current challenge is we can't make a good VR rig yet. We can't make a good AR, not even close to making a good AR rig.
Yeah.
So to suggest that we can make one thing that does either one of those, both of those well, like we're so a long ways from that.
Completely.
And there's definitely trade-offs. Ultimately, the VR in AR or the AR in VR, depending on the physical environment that you're in, which one of those two might make sense, might make more sense, might be the way that the camera phone has gone, evolved over time.
Yeah.
Right? It's a piece of junk camera initially, but it's the camera you have with you. And so you use it.
Yeah.
And then over time, we invest enough in it to make it pretty darn good.
Yeah, makes sense.
We shall see. Anyway, on to this next enlightening round question. Besides the one you are building, what tool or service do you wish existed in the AR market?
It's tricky. I think the most frustrating thing for us is the varying performance between mobile devices. It's really hard to think about, you know, something supporting Apple and Google right now. And then even within those things, the various functionalities. So, you know, using, you know, LiDAR, for example, on the iPhone 12 Pro gives you a blindingly good experience. As soon as you go back just one to iPhone 11, it's not the same experience. And then, you know, Android, I guess Android's announced the Pixel 6. I'm hoping and praying that it's something like LiDAR is coming in it. I can't imagine how it's not, but they haven't said yet. And so anything that can help to bridge that and make it easier to have an experience where you can think about the multitude of devices. It's why console is so much better to develop for than PC, right? You know exactly what PlayStation 5 is capable of. And so when you make a game, you're on a fixed format. As soon as you think about PC, and it used to be worse when machines were slower, you had so many different setups to think about and graphics cards and everything else. Mobile AR is the same thing. And because the App Store requires you to support everything back to like an iPhone 6 with a high-end AR experience, it makes it really hard to try to push any bounds because of the fact that, you know, you'll get nailed by the App Store reviews as soon as it isn't performant on, you know, a specific person's archaic device. So anything that would exist, you know, AR Foundation tries to do this, but the more we can push towards making that gentler for developers, I'd say the better. You know, object recognition stuff and machine learning too, so that we don't have to rely so much on LiDAR. You know, anything else that we can do to understand the space is super important. I think fundamental to AR gameplay being good is having some ability to know what's in front of the user. Otherwise, what's the point? It may as well be VR. If we can't have any understanding of the scene, it just seems like AR is worthless.
And here you're talking about not just having kind of a geometric understanding, but some sort of semantic understanding as well.
Yeah.
What book have you read recently that you found to be deeply insightful or profound?
I feel like I'm playing to this conversation, but I would say Fall or Dodge in Hell. I quote a lot lately, Neal Stephenson's book. Have you read that?
I have not.
Really good. It's very long, 600 some odd pages, and it really splits down the center. It becomes a very different book. But you know, it's typical Neal Stephenson sort of future of what we can expect, and everyone's got AR glasses on, and the implications of it are amazing. He talks about everyone's got their glasses, but it's all filtered to who you are, right? So if you're conservative, the only stuff that you're seeing on your screen is the stuff that feeds that cycle, right? And you pay people to edit your newsfeed so that you don't even have to see the stuff that runs sort of contrary to your opinions. And I thought that was terrifying. I mean, we're already seeing it now, but can you imagine in the future if it's on your head and all you're seeing is the stuff that reinforces your stereotypes? But going back to the idea that how could we all live in one metaverse together? You know, it's all about this sort of simulated future, and you can't. I guess the answer is you can't. We can't all live together in a world, and fighting's going to happen. But yeah, it's a great read.
All right, I'm definitely going to check that one out. If you could sit down and have coffee with your 25-year-old self, what advice would you share with 25-year-old Susan?
I've given other, you know, some people younger than me the same advice. I would say, don't be afraid to take on stuff that you're really not sure you know how to do. And, you know, I've encountered that constantly in my career, the feeling that I'm a little bit out of my depth and I'm taking something on and I'm not quite sure I even know where to start. And you have to go with it. You have to surround yourself with great people, hire the people who know the things that you don't, you know. And that was, I think, the reason that the Fictioneer stuff went so well was we hired an amazing team. We hired like two great leaders, Richard Sackers, who came out of Vodafone, has been our ran operations for 3 years. And I've never experienced being around someone who was just so solid, the sort of person who could just, you know, if he said something wasn't a problem, it really wasn't a problem. And it's just so wonderful being around people like that. And so that's the answer, is you if you don't know it, you find out the answers. But I think you really have to be willing to throw yourself into those situations where you feel uncomfortable. And that's the only way you can grow.
Yeah, what great advice. What great advice. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
Oh, I guess the biggest one is I really don't think it's too early for all of this, you know, in terms of if there are investors who are listening to this. I hope people start to take risks. It's not going to be the quick wins, but if this is going to work, like, now is the time to, I'm get up so excited and motivated about the stuff that we're doing, even if it's going to take time to sort of realize the results of it and the financial win of it. It's just so cool. We have this, like, you know, once in a generation opportunity to figure out what this metaverse stuff or whatever you want to call it is. And, you know, playing in AR, playing in XR, pushing the boundaries is just really neat. As a game industry person, it'd be really easy for me to just go back to making traditional games right now. And there's so much money being thrown out there for making traditional games. And so it's taking a lot of courage, I think, to say, that's all fine, but we're doing this new stuff and we're going to be there. And that's something to get out of bed for, in a way that I think just going back to sort of safe traditional games wouldn't feel for me right now.
Yeah. Where can people go to learn more about what you're doing at Tiny Rebel Games and more about you generally?
Our website's tinyrebelgames.com, which is where you can hear about the stuff that we're doing at Tiny Rebel, and I'm on LinkedIn and on Twitter.
Awesome. Susan, thanks very much for the conversation.
Thank you.
Before you go, I want to tell you about the next episode. In it, I speak with Paul Powers, the founder and CEO of Fizna. You may have caught Fizna in the news recently because they raised $76 million over the last year, including $56 million earlier this summer from Tiger Global, Sequoia, and others. Paul and his team have created a new way to search and compare 3D models in a way that's faster and more effective than what's come before. This ability to recognize and understand physical objects, combined with FANGs, their online database of 3D models, creates the potential for them to become the Google search of AR. Paul's a great storyteller and an insightful entrepreneur. I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. Please follow or subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss this or other great episodes. Until next time.